Young people from all over the globe are joining up to fight for the future.
I'm doing my part.
I'm doing my part.
I'm doing my part.
I'm doing my part, too.
They're doing their part. Are you? Join the mobile infantry and save the world. Service guarantees citizenship.
I want to serve, and I want to better my country as much as I can.
Both my mom and dad were employed, and they're both in the Army. And my mom was an Army dentist, and my dad was an artilleryman.
It was May 28th, 1981, when I first took the oath of enlistment in the United States Navy. The words are still pretty plain. They're still pretty ingrained. I, David Ray Bowman, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, and that I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me, according to the regulations in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So help me God. We have talked about this in the past. I've talked about it in the past, particularly in the context of Constitution Thursday, with what did I actually know about the Constitution of the United States on May 28th, 1981, compared to what I would know years later after finishing my military service and moving on into radio and beginning Constitution Thursday. And to me, it was always a remarkable contrast, a remarkable comparison to the idea that what I knew on May 28th, 1981 versus what I know now is so massively different. June 21st, 1985, for the second time, I took the enlistment oath when I re-enlisted for another 6 years. I don't know that I knew any more about the Constitution at that point, but I knew a bit more about people. I knew that the people who were surrounding me while I took that oath were people that I trusted. They were officers appointed over me, and they were good men, and they were leaders, and they were people for whom I had come to believe had the Navy's best interest and the country's best interest at heart. And I trusted them. I trusted them to the point where if Lieutenant Fritch had told me, or Master Chief Adamson had told me the night before, "Bowman, we need you to walk on water in the morning," I would have been up all night practicing because I wouldn't have wanted to let them down. That's the kind of loyalty that they had imbued in me, I suppose. Revolving around that oath as officers appointed over me. So it was with some surprise, I guess, this morning that I read the news that the Navy has decided that all its personnel, all its sailors, are going to retake the oath of enlistment. Now, before we get really into this, I want to be clear about this. I don't really have a problem with that. I don't really have a problem with restating the oath of enlistment, retaking the oath of enlistment. Why? I think it serves a purpose. I think it really does. I think it's a reminder, and you know, we don't have any problem drilling the 11 general orders of a century into our recruits. We make them say those 4, 5, 6, 10, 12 times a day. And here it is all these years later. And while I may not have them memorized to the degree I did then, I still know them. The Nuclear Weapons Manual, C-8120, which doesn't even exist anymore, I know. That's how old I am. I knew that thing forward, backwards, inside out. I typed it up so many times because I was the weapons department yeoman. This is the main lesson I would share with you from this is never let the Navy know that you know how to type, even though I technically don't. But I'd become very good at what I do. So I became the weapons department yeoman, which meant that I had to type, retype every lessons learned, every change, every modification, every whatever to the policies and procedures manual. I got to the point where I knew those things inside and outside. And we repeated that. We would quiz each other. We would walk up to each other and say, hey, what's section blah, 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 what's the third nuclear weapons rule? And you would have to recite it. But for some reason, we never really do that with the oath. We didn't, you know, you said it when you enlisted and that was it. Or when you re-enlisted and that was it. But really, the content there is very important. I solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of officers appointed over me, according to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. These are important concepts. They really are. And I think that talking about them more often may have been beneficial. We didn't, for whatever reason. When I joined the Navy in 1981, the Navy was, not exactly sure what the word for it is. There were a lot of people who warned me not to join the Navy. There were a lot of people who said, you don't want to be a part of that. In the 1970s, the Navy had two very serious problems. A drug problem that was in the process of being rooted out. It was still, I don't want to call it a problem when I was in, but it was still there. There were still elements of that drug use issue, particularly the marijuana. There was an incident when I was in A school, and I don't want to be self-deprecating here, but I was extremely naive when it came to that stuff. I didn't know, I'd never seen a joint. Again, I was raised in a very conservative Christian minister's family and in Utah, and I didn't know anything about that stuff. I really had no idea. And the first time I saw a joint, I had no idea what it was. No clue. And that created a problem because I didn't know what it was. Well, why didn't you report this? Report what? I don't know what we're talking about. And literally, I had to undergo an hour-long interview because I didn't know what a joint was. Anyway, long story short, the other problem that the Navy had in the 1970s was a race problem. I was told that on aircraft carriers, and particularly aircraft carriers, there were areas of the ships that were no-go areas. If you were a certain skin color, you didn't go into that section of the ship. You just didn't go there. And if you were the other color, you didn't go in these other areas. And if you did, the tensions it would create could possibly lead to, and at least in one case did lead to, known riots aboard Navy vessels, race riots. Now, two things here. One, by the time I got in 1981, and that had happened in the mid-70s, Vietnam had been winding down. Vietnam was a very racially divisive thing. That was over and forgotten. It was a new morning in America with Ronald Reagan. There was a great deal more patriotism, I guess, is the best way to put it. There was a good deal more willingness to put those things aside. And the second thing was I was in submarine fleet, which I was going to be blunt about this. We don't have time for that shit in the submarines. We just don't. Believe me, if you're a racist in the submarines, you keep it to yourself. And if you don't keep it to yourself, well, you're going to be, well, you're not going to be there much longer. That's just the way it is. We don't have time for that shit. We go down together. We come up together. My life depends as much on the next guy as his life does depend on mine. And it doesn't matter what race he is, what color he is, what creed he is. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is, does he know his stuff? Is he qualified to do this or not? If he is, great. If he isn't, well, then we might have problems. Generally, we get rid of problems. And I can honestly say that in my time in the Navy, particularly aboard USS Michigan, I don't recall any overt cases of racism. Now, there were always jokes. I'm not going to kid you about that. There were always funny things that were said, but they were obviously jokes. There was never any, I don't recall anyone in my service time that clearly was what you would call a racist. Now, there may have been, but if there were, they kept it to themselves. In my time, this was pre don't ask, don't tell. If you were gay, you didn't, you could be in the military. You just didn't let anybody know. If you wanted to get out of the military, then you told everybody, hey, I'm gay, and they booted you out. There were gay people on the submarine. Some of them were very good friends of mine. Yes, I was still naive, and maybe I knew it. Maybe I didn't know it. I don't really know for sure in some cases, but it never bothered me. It never affected me. It never concerned me in any way, shape, or form. Because again, what matters is, are they qualified or not? Can I trust this person with my life or not? And if the answer is yes, then none of the other stuff mattered. It really didn't. Apparently, though, in the ensuing 40 years, things have changed in the military. They let women on submarines now. They do things that I'm not sure. I'm just not sure how well I would handle it, to be honest with you. There's some things about the Navy now that concern me deeply. But again, it's not my Navy. I'm long gone. I'm as distant from the kids today as the World War II vets were from when I joined. It's a weird feeling. But the Navy announced a few weeks ago that there would be a Navy-wide, actually all the armed services did, but the Navy particularly put its date on it, that there would be a stand down. And why would this stand down occur? Well, the stand down is to deal with extremism in the Navy. Now, stand downs are nothing new, nor are they unusual. During my time, we had two while I was in. Both of them were safety related, as I recall. One of them might have been tailhook related. I'm trying to remember. But one was definitely safety related. The Navy went through this phase in the mid 80s where, God, it was like every day there was an accident. And almost all of them were on aircraft carriers. People getting run over, people getting sucked into jet engines, people dropping stuff on themselves. And so everybody in the Navy had to have a safety stand down day. And I remember it very distinctly because we were an off crew and sitting in the office with our safety stand down, which consisted primarily of, as I recall, it consisted primarily of donuts and coffee. But be that as it may, the entire Navy stopped everything we were doing for an entire day so that we could talk about safety. Did it work? I don't know. People still got hurt. People still got injured. Accidents still happen because it's a dangerous freaking job. We don't think about that, though. At any rate, this particular stand down is coming about because there is a concern that there is a great deal of extremism in the United States Navy. Now, this extremism is not necessarily defined. It's the words of the chief of naval personnel, Vice Admiral John Knoll, where the stand down will focus on the quote damaging effects of extremism and how to eliminate it. But as part of this dealing with the damaging effects of extremism and how to deal with it, every member of the Navy is going to have to retake the oath of enlistment. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. It's, in the words of the Admiral, whether extremists are in the ranks is no longer debatable. It's really just about to what degree. I'm concerned about this because, again, this is all based in and post January 6th, during which we are told, the exact quote here, quote, several veterans, reservist, and a National Guard member were involved. As far as we're aware, there were no active duty military people involved, but several veterans, and again, we don't define what that is. We don't say what period, we don't talk about any of that. Several veterans, what was the other one? Reservists and a National Guard member were involved. And so clearly the definition now of extremism is Trump voter, Trump supporter. I mean, there's an element here that if I was defining extremism as neo-Nazism or racism or communism, I think I would understand that. But we're defining it as something completely different, aren't we? We are defining this as Trump voting. If you voted for Trump, you, sir, are potentially an extremist. And therefore, we need to have a stand down because of the damaging effects you are having. That's my concern. Now, again, if this is all about neo-Nazism and communism, fine. But socialism, fine. But something tells me that it isn't. Something tells me that it's more about people who have what's known as a conservative originalist view of this Constitution of ours are now the extremists. And we've seen this coming for a while, haven't we? We've seen this all the way back to the Obama administration when veterans were listed as potentially dangerous subversives. Remember that report that came out post 9/11 and how veterans are dangerous? Well, are veterans, and again, anybody can be a terrorist. There's no checklist that says you have to have this, 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 and this. But are we really saying that because one guy or one gal did, or two gals or two guys or whatever did, that makes everybody one, potentially? Is that really what we've come to believe? Is that the level of paranoia we've reached, that under every rock, every blade of grass, under every butt kit, is a potential terrorist? This is not the way of things that I remember. This is not the way of things that I recall. When you're asking people to do something, to do a job that is, number one, dangerous. I've said this so many times, I don't know how many times to say it, but the ocean is always trying to kill you. The sea will try to kill you. It always is. It does not like you. It may look calm and serene, but it hates you, and it is trying to kill you. And if you screw up, it will. It's a dangerous job. Going to sea on a ship is dangerous, period. And that's before you even go to war. Going to sea on a ship is dangerous. So we're asking people to do a dangerous job. We're asking them to do a job that separates them from loved ones, families, and friends, and the likes of that. And in my time, communication, I mean, nowadays I understand it's a little different, but in my days, well, you know how much of a baseball guy I am. I saw the 1986 World Series, Game 6, you know, the famous Billy Buckner error. I saw that game in December of 1986 on videotape. We're separating people from everything that they know and love. We're feeding them, we're taking care of them, but we're asking them to do something potentially to fight that could cost them their lives on top of everything else. In my world, I would go to sleep with the idea that I could be woken up to the 1MC going, alert one, man battle stations for strategic launch at any moment. I could be asked to push a button that would essentially launch a Trident C-4 missile at a target designated by the President of the United States to follow those orders. We're asking people to do this. And yet now we're paranoid about, well, who's trustworthy, who's not. 25,000 troops sent to the Capitol building to defend the Capitol, which, by the way, has the 19th largest police force in the country. I don't know if you knew that. they couldn't handle it. So we had to bring in 25,000 troops. And what was the concern about the troops? Well, we don't know if they're loyal or not. I think we do, but we're going to pretend that we don't so that we can create yet another problem. And I think that's what this is. I think this idea of looking for extremism in the military is looking for a problem because we need to distract from other things. Like maybe our military really isn't ready to fight the way it should be. There's an article here that they reference about a young man, one guy, who had neo-Nazi tattoos on his arm when he enlisted and apparently was very open about the fact, you know, I'm a neo-Nazi. I helped found a neo-Nazi organization. And the army took him anyway. And then they were surprised 5 years later when they had to kick him out because he's an extremist. He's a neo-Nazi. Yeah, you knew that. You knew that all along. The reason they kicked him out is because it became politically untenable. And the question I'm left with is, well, two questions. One, do I have a problem with retaking the oath? No, I don't. I don't have a problem with retaking the oath. Why? Well, number one, I re-enlisted. I took it twice myself. I wish that I had the foresight during that time to remind myself of that oath every day. In your faith, you have prayers or mantras or whatever that you remind yourself of every day. In Judaism, we have the Shema. We teach ourselves by reminding ourselves of nuclear weapons rules and rules for sentries and stuff. We grind that stuff into ourselves. Maybe it would be a good thing to have the oath done that way. What have I learned that's different from 5/28/81 to now? I've learned more about the Constitution than I ever even imagined existed in those days. And it created trust because I knew that everyone around me had taken that same oath. I knew that we had agreed to our purpose and agreed to our function and agreed to our processes. And therefore, we all understood the rules of the game and we were going to keep going. And maybe retaking the oath, I don't know, monthly, daily, it doesn't matter. Would remind ourselves of that instead of worrying about extremists. The biggest question you had to ask yourself is if the military really has this problem with an influx of extremists, whatever you define that as being, shouldn't we be asking the question, why? And wouldn't the answer have to involve the fact that we are now in the 20th year of a never-ending freaking war against an ethereal ideology, not a country, not a group, an ideology that it can exist anywhere, that we can use as a boogeyman to pop up and go, look, he's over there. We got to go to war over there. Look, they're over there. Now we got to go to war over there. Mali, Chad. Wouldn't part of the problem be that we need the manpower to maintain this never-ending war against ideologies? And sooner or later, people start figuring out that this is all BS and they don't want to join anymore. And so you start scraping the bottom of the barrel to get people to be your cannon fodder somewhere. I'm just thinking to myself that maybe that's the real problem. We're not being selective because we're using our military incorrectly, wrongly, and foolishly by politicians who might actually be, dun, 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 the real extremists here.